We'll order the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. It is 8:37. Good morning, committee members. This is the beginning of 4 to 6 bills per session, or per meeting, that we have on the agenda. So we have a busy one today, and we're also going to try to accommodate legislators who have other schedules that they have to meet. So we're going to change the order from the agenda. We'll hear House Bill 2673 first, then we will hear HM1, then House Bill 3176, then 2791, then 2674, and then finally 2644. We'll hear last at the request of Mr. Burroughs, who surprised us by saying it's okay to go last. So, thank you, Dave. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Committee members, also, if it is the intent of the chair to give a public hearing to any bill that is sponsored by a member of this committee, a full public hearing and work session. If you have any bills and you have not let me know, please do so, because we are in the final stages of trying to schedule our next 2 weeks of which bills we will be seeing. So we would appreciate that very much. Okay, we will take our item number one, which is House Bill 2673, and we'll open a public hearing on 2673, and we welcome Representatives Haas and Williams. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for hearing this bill. My name is Mark Haas, House District 27. We put forward House Bill 2673 not because our current system is overwhelmed with abuses to our land use laws, but to reinstate the confidence of citizens in the integrity of public officials. The concept of this bill is very simple. It simply requires public officials to disclose potential conflicts of interest based on certain criteria and using the reasonable person test when making land use decisions. And if an official does have a potential conflict of interest, they must recuse themselves from participating on that land use decision. If an individual does not disclose that potential conflict of interest, the land use decision may be remanded by the Land Use Board of Appeals. Oregon law already prohibits public officials from using their law, from using their office for personal gain. However, those problems are complaint-driven and are regulated by a rapidly disappearing Government Practices and Standards Commission. In addition, those statutes don't cover the family or business relationships that sometimes create a real or perceived conflict by public officials. This measure would apply to city councils, county commissions, planning commissions, and all quasi-judicial bodies, including Metro and LCDC. Section 6 deals with what happens in a case where a conflict is discovered after the fact and is not disclosed. It says that the Land Use Board of Appeals can remand the decision back to the governing body. However, LUBA does have the discretion to uphold the decision if it finds that the participation of the local decision maker did not affect the outcome, and this was done to make this bill reasonable and to inject some common sense. Now, you should know this bill passed the House last session 50-10, and it passed the Senate in the session before 24-4, and we're hoping that we can get both chambers to pass it both times in the same year. This is good government. It helps reinforce to the citizens of Oregon that their government is open and fair, and I respectfully ask for your support in moving this to the House of Lords.
Any questions of Representative Hawk? Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Max Williams, State Representative, House District 35. I'm pleased to join Representative Haas in bringing you House Bill 2673 today. Last session, Representative Haas was one of the chief sponsors on a bill called House Bill 3908, which essentially addresses the same issues that are before you today. It was referred to the Judiciary Committee last session, which I chaired. In its initial form, I did not support the bill because I thought it went too far by including campaign contributions as another kind of relationship that would require local officials to recuse themselves from land use proceedings. It was my belief at that time, with that breadth in the bill, that it would create inherent problems in the ability of local government to make decisions. During that time, House Bill 3908 received three hearings in the Judiciary Committee and underwent several rounds of amendments to address not only my concerns, but the concerns of other parties in the process as well as members of the committee. The end result was essentially the bill that you have before you today. Throughout this process, this session, as one of the chief sponsors on this bill, I have not been approached by a single party who has expressed to me their opposition to this bill. In the end, as Representative Hass indicated, the bill unanimously passed out of the House Judiciary Committee and then passed on the House with 50 votes. I believe this is a good bill that will improve the public's confidence in the integrity of local land use decisions and also state-level land use decisions because of its impact on decisions by the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and I would urge your support. I note that this session, House Bill 2673, currently has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. I am happy to distribute to members of the committee a copy of the staff report for House Bill 3908 from last session, which indicated that there was no actual fiscal impact as a result of the bill. There was no fiscal impact statement produced, and that was not an issue in the last legislative session. With this in mind, I would urge the committee not only to support this bill, but to discuss with the Speaker's office the deletion of the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, both because of their workload and because of its inappropriateness given no fiscal impact on this bill, and then move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I do appreciate the Chair's willingness to allow this bill to come forward today and to granting us our opportunity to testify in its support. I'd be pleased to answer any questions that the committee has.
Any questions of Representative Williams? Representative Ackerman?
Council.
Yes, Representative.
Oh, this will be good.
We do this all the time in this committee. It's one of my favorite things about coming to this committee.
The standard, of course, is actual apparent conflict of interest. And I did not have time to research the bill well enough to know whether those terms are adequately defined in ORS 197 so that, or some other statute so that the person to which this standard apply have some idea of what that, those terms mean.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I do believe that in the issues of requiring public officials to declare conflicts of interest, that both actual and potential conflict of interest is defined by statute. And it's currently essentially the same kinds of definitions that we use in our process and having to declare those actual and potential conflicts of interest. So I do believe that they are defined currently, and I think that this would dovetail those definitions appropriately.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Zahn.
Max, I have two on the Planning Commission in Woodburn. I have two people that own real estate in Woodburn. They'd have to declare a conflict, but could they vote? Or would they have to, how would that be set up? Because
Representative Zahn, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, if you look in what is Section 4 of the bill, it simply says that a past or present business relationship between the local decision maker and a party to the proceeding, or a family relationship between the local decision maker and a party to the proceeding. If they currently own real estate now and they own it themselves personally and they're transacting business involving that, I think they already have responsibilities for their declaration of their conflict and how that process works. This bill simply addresses the issue where it's a person that you've had a business relationship with, but maybe you don't actually own the real estate, or it's a situation where you have a family member who owns the real estate as defined by the bill, and it puts on your obligations to declare that conflict and how that process is supposed to work. To the extent that you are currently already owning a piece of real estate and the decision you're making at the local level impacts real estate that you already own, that is already currently covered by the law and how one would declare a conflict of interest and manage that decision.
Thanks,
Max. So it's really trying to get at those sort of two issues that currently don't require any declaration of conflict.
Also, Max, on that subject, did this have an effect on a declaration of a potential conflict of interest by a commissioner or a local government official? In other words, someone may not directly be gaining from any kind of a decision, but because there is an interest somewhere along the lines, quite often an elected official will declare a potential conflict of interest. Does this bill affect that in any way?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, again, if you look at the language of the bill on page 2 near the top, starting with section 4, I guess on page 1, it says, in addition to the requirements under chapter 244, before taking final action on an application for a land use decision, a limited land use decision, or an expedited land division, a local decision maker shall disclose the following, if applicable: a past or present business relationship between the local decision maker and a party to the proceeding, or a family relationship between the local decision maker and a party to the proceeding.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a related question to what the chair just asked. Because in this body, it seems like people declare conflicts of interest all the time when they really don't need to, just because when in doubt, you don't want to risk not having declared one. And I guess the question that I heard just asked, and I'll ask again, is would this lead to people declaring conflicts of interest because there was a gray area when they don't really need to? Because my reading of this bill is that once you've declared a conflict, you can't vote on the matter before you, which may already be the law. I'm not familiar with it. So do you think it could bog down the process by people just declaring conflicts because they had a question that there might be one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I guess it's, again, my belief that because you've defined in the statute, in this bill, the two areas where you would need to declare additional conflict, one being a past or present business relationship with somebody who's a party who has business before the local government body, or B, a family member as defined by the statute, which narrowly defines it to immediate family members or their spouses, essentially, in-laws. I think to the extent that there are more of those events occurring, you would have more declarations of conflict. I think the bill was written to allow a person to continue to sit for purposes of the decision in order to maintain quorum of the body, so that there wouldn't be necessarily any violation of the quorum requirement, so they could continue to transact business, but they wouldn't vote. And that's a different situation that is currently applied to local government when they have a conflict on a vote. They do recuse themselves from the vote and don't vote. It's a situation which we don't enjoy, nor I think likely should we enjoy in the legislature, where we're obligated to vote even when we do have a conflict. And that's why I think you see a greater degree of careful declaration by us in our body, because we have to vote regardless, and one wants to be careful that if one is voting, they have actually made their declaration clear, whether it's a potential or an actual conflict of interest. I don't believe that this, I think it will expand indication points where people are going to declare conflict of interest that they might not currently declare. I think in the business of local government, particularly with the kinds of relationships that this bill is getting at, I don't view that as a bad thing. I view that as an appropriate level of openness that restores some confidence that, you know, you're not giving your sister-in-law a great deal. Even when there, in fact, might not be any negative or wrong reason to go forward with that, I think it actually protects local government actors from being accused in those situations of having, you know, some sort of self-dealing or interest in the process.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And just to clarify, is it the case right now then that if you're a local government official and you declare a conflict, you're not allowed to vote, but you can still participate? Is that just reiterating what the law is right now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I will confess, I know that you declare and I don't believe that you vote. I don't know whether or not the quorum, the maintenance of the quorum requirement is currently applied to Chapter 244 declarations or not. I don't know that answer.
I might add, this bill has, I'm very grateful to Representative Williams because of the work that was done in his committee in the last session to deal with these questions that have come up today, and we've got through a lot of those questions, and the bill is much evolved from what it started out to be, and to address some of these concerns that you're raising.
We always love simplification.
Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not sure it gets simplified, Mr. Chairman, but hopefully it gets better.
There you go. Any further questions? Representative Greenleg.
Representative Williams, I'll ask counsel questions again, not being an attorney.
The mass representative has. I feel like he's not getting enough playtime up here.
I ask him press relations questions. And, the clause isn't potential in here. It's apparent. And it's real or apparent conflict of interest, and talks about the reasonable person. That's on page 2, line 7, I think, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my definition of a reasonable man is the way I look at things, but I'm not sure everybody else has that exact same definition. Could you help me with a sense of what the legal context of that apparent conflict of interest under the reasonable person rule, how does that play out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I think that's a good question. I think the way it plays out is that it's a standard that gets applied regularly in the law in all sorts of contexts, where each of us is required to act not as we interpret what a reasonable person would do, but by a standard of what broadly the public at large would assume that a reasonable person would do. So it is a different standard than just what you think. It's a standard of what a broader group of people would assume that a reasonable person would act in this particular venue. And it's a difficult standard, but the reasonable person standard is a standard that's applied at many levels of the law in regulating the conduct of an individual. I think it's the reason why, for example, on the floor of the House, you'll find people who often declare conflict, where some of us will scratch our heads and say, well, I don't know if you needed to do that. But I think they're trying, and I think people are trying very carefully to ensure that they are meeting, what a reasonable person might assume ought to be declared for purposes of a conflict of interest. So I'll be the first to admit that there is a certain amount of squishiness in that standard. The question is, how do you otherwise quantify it? How else do you build a structure? And I think this bill falls back on a standard that's often used in the law to establish when people ought to act in a particular way.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
We thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your time on a busy morning.
And if you're interested, Mr. Chairman, I'll leave with your staff a copy of the committee report from last session.
Thank you, Representative. We have four people signed up to speak, plus we have a representative from the LFO here that can also clear up whether we need to send this to a referral to Ways and Means, in that we have a report that it's not necessary. So, Representative Scott, how's your time this morning? Okay, we'll expedite as quickly as we can. Randy Tucker.
Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Randy Tucker. I'm with Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, as you know. Some testimony is being distributed to you right now, and I was kind of up late putting it together and forgot to put it on letterhead, so it doesn't say anywhere that it's from 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And I even forgot to change one of the bill numbers from last session, so the second paragraph. So anyway, if you'll cross that out and put the proper bill number in, then I think we'll have it sorted together here. I am not going to read through all this testimony, and I think I'd be glad to try to answer some of the questions that you were just asking as well. But I do want to give you an example of the kind of thing that has caused this bill to come forward, and you can see the summary of one of the most egregious cases in the middle of the first page of the testimony here, in the paragraph that starts with the bold words, business relationships. It's a case that occurred in the late 80s with the Rajneesh Param commune, where the Rajneeshis were seeking a vote of the county commission to allow them to hold an incorporation vote. And right around, just coincidentally, around the time that they were seeking that vote, they entered into a business relationship with one of the county commissioners to buy a bunch of cattle, beef cattle, and I did not live here at the time, but I think the Rajneeshis were vegetarians, if I'm not mistaken. The transaction was entered into prior to the vote, and then the payment was made after the vote. They said on the record that they entered into this transaction because they needed his vote, and yet the Oregon Supreme Court found that there was no duty to disclose the contract and sale because, in the mind of the county official, it was an unrelated business transaction. So that gets to this question of apparent conflict of interest and appearance of bias and other impropriety that is reflected in the language of this bill. I would also call your attention to the last page of the testimony, the very back of the testimony that I've distributed. It has a sort of down and dirty summary of this bill for you. I don't think I should walk all the way through it. I do want to mention that there are some typos in this bill. For instance, on page 1, line 8, it talks about the ethical standards described in Section 3 of this 2003 Act, but actually those ethical standards are in Section 4. The bill has been sort of rearranged since last session. There's a sort of an egregious typo on page 3, line 9, where there's a sort of stranded ORS. It's meaningless in the context of this statute. And then there's one other, again, a technical fix that needs to be made on page 2, which I'm glad to explain, but it's not substantive. With that, I think rather than going through this rather lengthy testimony, and given that you've got several other bills, I think I'd prefer to just let you ask questions if you'd rather have me approach this that way.
Thank you, Randy. I think that'd be appreciated. Representative Dillon.
I guess my trouble with this bill is that it's specific to, land use officials. I mean, why that and not, more broader reach, I guess.
Sure.
Really looking at what the Government Standards and Ethics Commission already does.
Actually, Mr. Chair and Representative Doyle, that actually goes to a question that I should have already tried to answer before I asked for your questions. Questions that you were asking the representatives a little bit ago. First of all, of course, we only work on land use, so this is what we care about. There is a separate decision-making process for land use decisions. Second, I think the important thing to note with respect to some of the questions that were already being asked is that the decisions that are addressed in this bill, for the most part, at least at the local level, not the LCDC level, per se, are quasi-judicial decisions. They are decisions that are made by elected officials who are not judges, but the standard is, and I'm not a lawyer, so I may not have this exactly right, but I assume that there are attorneys on the committee that can correct me if I'm wrong. The standard is the decision should be getting made on the facts and the law and not on a policy judgment or a political judgment in these cases. The participants in that decision have the right to an impartial tribunal. And we're focusing on that kind of decision where you've got a particular case at issue rather than a large-scale legislative or policy decision for the most part. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, Representative, but...
Well, I mean, it explains why your interest is in that direction. I guess my concern is that we are focused strictly on one area of government when we have, obviously, other commissions that are also engaged in, these kind of decision-making processes. And we have a whole, new hearings officer panel that are all ALJs now that, I would expect be subject to, or should be subject to, similar kind of requirements if they're not already. And it just... just kind of concerns me that we want to focus strictly on one area of state government without looking at a broader context.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, of course, the problem we're trying to solve is one that we've seen in the land use process. We certainly have no objection to addressing this issue in other contexts, but that involves amending different statutes that we just don't work on. So,
any other questions, Representative Ackerman?
Yes. I'm going to go back to a point I was making with Representative Williams, that is the definition of actual or apparent conflict of interest. I know those words are defined in other portions of the statute, and I also know that
that this bill overlaps certain provisions of ORS Chapter 244. And in 244, actual conflict of interest is defined, but apparent conflict of interest is not, but there is something defined called potential conflict of interest. Would you think it would be better in terms of the crafting of this bill if we would incorporate those definitions for the undefined terms apparent and actual apparent conflict of interest in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that question was raised to me in the back of the room during the testimony from Representative Williams and Haas. We did attempt to reconcile Chapter 244's provisions with this bill last session, and I don't recall the exact resolution of the particular question that you're asking, and I think because we're going to be amending this bill, I'm going to ask your leave to take a look at that outside the hearing. I don't know the answer to your question. But if I may take a stab at it, I think the term potential is in 244 is referring to a conflict where there is a possibility of gain by the decision maker, if I'm not mistaken. This is not about that. This bill is about a different kind of conflict, the kind that undermines people's confidence in the integrity of a decision, even irrespective of whether the decision maker is potentially profiting in some way from the decision. So we're trying to get at something different. We're trying to get at the business relationship, of course, could involve profit, but we're trying to get at the question of whether the public has confidence in the idea that these decisions are being made based on the facts and the law and not based on some other factor.
Mm-hmm. Well, my major point is that an actual apparent conflict of interest in the mind of the decision maker, I believe, unless that's fairly well defined, it allows the decision maker off the hook. And many times, well, I don't know what definition you're replying to. You know, I look in this code, I look in that code, it's not right. Defined. What does it mean? And I could see that as being a major defense for someone that should otherwise disclose right. And conform to the law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, we're actually trying to get out of the idea that the decision maker, it's in their own mind. The decision, in response to some objections, actually, I think two sessions ago, we changed the language in on page 2, line 9. It says the local decision maker shall refrain from participation in the proceedings if the local decision maker determines that the disclosed circumstances constitute in the mind of a reasonable person, etc. Initially, the language said that if the governing body determined, and it was felt by, I believe it was Mr. Chandler that brought that issue to us a couple sessions ago, that if you've got a majority on a governing body that disagrees with a minority, they can pretty much, you know, railroad the minority into never participating in the decisions. Legitimate concern, that was changed so that the decision maker himself makes the determination, but they should be making the determination based on what a reasonable person would think and not based on whether they, in their own mind, think that there's a conflict. And so you'll see in the rest of the sentence, you know, in the mind of a reasonable person.
Mm-hmm.
So the focus isn't on, do I think I'm doing something questionable, but what's the smell test out there, you know? Does this make this decision by our body look questionable to the public?
And I think that's, if I might make one comment, I think that's a good move. I still think a reasonable person standard can be confused because these terms aren't defined. What would a reasonable person conclude if apparent conflict of interest is not defined in ORS 277 or 197? How far out would a reasonable person have to go to conjure up what that standard means?
Right.
And I can just, again, I think we should tighten this down so that even though it's a reasonable person standard, that reasonable person standard is directly related to legislatively defined concepts of actual or apparent conflict of interest. Otherwise, again, I think that these people can skate on this.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jackson, I'm glad to work with you on that. I think, you know, if you loop back to the idea of there's a family relationship or a business relationship, that is sort of the trigger for the question of whether there's a a reasonable person would find an actual apparent conflict of interest. And the reasonable person standard is in there. So, for instance, we talked about this last session. Let's say I'm a local decision maker and somebody testified before me, and in the eighth grade I sold them some baseball cards or something. You know, that's obviously a reasonable person would not find a conflict of interest. But if I'm engaged in a real estate transaction currently or recently or prospectively with that person, a reasonable person would see that there's a business relationship there. And we're trying to not have this be so rigid that any kind of a transaction between any two individuals would trigger a the remand of a decision. So it's if you as has been testified in other contexts earlier this session, you tighten things down and you know you get a lot more objectivity and you get a lot less flexibility. And so we're leaving some discretion in the hands, or this bill leaves some discretion in the hands of Luba to take a look at this and say what's reasonable. That's the intent, at any rate. And if we haven't gotten there, we're certainly glad to work on it.
Any further questions of Mr. Tubb?
A comment.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, and kind of in line with what Representative Ackerman was saying, I don't see why there isn't the possibility to make a definition here. Because to leave it this broad certainly does keep it open, but it also asks LUBA to be making a number of decisions, and if the losing end of some debate doesn't feel that they want to accept that decision, now they've got a means of appeal. And I don't see why we couldn't develop language which would say something that would encompass pending or expected business opportunities, increased value of property that you may own or control. I mean, there could be language that could be devised that would give some parameters as to when there is this potential conflict and when there isn't, and then that could be expanded as we get a feel for whether or not this statute does what it's intended to do.
May I respond just briefly to Representative Chair Garrard, Representative Richardson? There is, at least on page one, a definition of a business relationship. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it goes some in the direction of answering your question. Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Tucker? Saying none, thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
You'll be sticking around for a bit. Okay. Linda Ludberg? We'll ask that you try to. We have two more speakers. If you will hold your comments, give us the Reader's Digest version. We'd appreciate it.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities here today to talk about HB 2673. And yes, I'll try to be very brief. As you heard, this is the third session this bill has come up. We have seen it come up now three sessions. The bill has changed substantially each time. This time we have a new conflict of interest standard apparent. But in our eyes, this bill hasn't gotten any better. The bill sets up three different standards for public officials to consider when making decisions. One, the current standard, which is required of all public officials and housed in Chapter 244 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And the standard in this bill, which would be housed in Chapter 197, relative to quasi-judicial land use decisions. The bill not only sets up differing standards, but it uses differing terminology than what you'll see in your little green book that GSPC enforces. Which, the most troubling of all these definitional differences, are the different types of conflicts of interest. In 244, the prohibition is with regard to actual or potential conflicts of interest. In this bill, we have actual conflicts of interest, and we have apparent conflicts of interest, which, as has been noted by Representative Ackerman and several of you, is not precisely or even defined at all. The definition of circumstances that would constitute an apparent conflict of interest in the minds of a reasonable person is very, very troubling, I think, for elected officials or even judges to figure out what that really means. This bill brings up several other questions as well. Under Chapter 244, the current standards, elected officials are required to disclose an actual conflict of interest and not participate in the proceedings, including the vote. In this bill, the elected official can participate, as long as he or she does not vote when they declare an apparent conflict of interest. This is an incredibly confusing standard for elected officials to try to guess when they come under Chapter 244 rules and when they would come up under Chapter 197 rules. Additionally, when you think about this, not only Planning Commission members, but City Council members would be under the requirements of this bill. Now, for most of their decisions, City Council members would be required to make their decisions about conflicts of interest and when they do declare and when they don't under Chapter 244. But in some circumstances now, they will have to do another set of standards under 197. And as hard as this has been for me to get around what those differing standards are, when not, they cannot participate, and under which types of votes they have to apply those standards, I can only imagine being up there at a city council meeting trying to figure those things at the same time as trying to decide whether or not we need to declare conflict. There's other definitional differences in what's considered business or a business relationship here, as well as in the bill. Differences in those family members and what are relatives that are applicable. And I think these differences would lead to greater degrees of confusion. Also, who is the enforcer of the ethics violation under this bill? There is no reference to that in the bill. Again, under 244, GSPC is the enforcer of these violations. My position is pretty plain and simple. If there really is a pressing need to change our conflict of interest standards that we hold our public officials to do, let's do it in a comprehensive manner. Let's do it in a way that's not going to be confusing. Let's do it and make it applicable to all public officials in Chapter 244. Also, I believe, in my opinion, the underlying result of the passage of this bill might be to continue to dampen our ability to recruit our volunteers to become elected officials. As you know, 99% of those on the city side are not paid and they have 9-to-5 jobs. And I don't think this would be desirable, as if Representative Hess stated, there really aren't any abuses this bill is trying to address, but they're trying to reinstate the confidence of public officials. I don't see that this bill is going to accomplish that.
Thank you, Linda. Any questions?
Just a very brief one, sir.
A brief?
On page 2, line 17 through 21, it seems in direct conflict with what's in the book you pass out. I mean, the book you pass out says, if an official's vote is necessary for the public body to achieve a quorum, the official may vote but may not discuss or debate the issue. It looks like this bill would say the opposite. It would say that if it's needed for a quorum, they can participate but they can't vote. Is that, and this I think comes out of 244.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick. The bill turns upside down what is appropriate in Chapter 244. I have the big print version here. It's a little easier for my eyes to read.
Representative, we have Jim Nass here in the back of the room who is representing the Judicial Department, and that perhaps might be a better question for him to answer.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
In order to extend the courtesy to Representative Scott, we're going to temporarily recess the public hearing on 2673 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3176. Representative Scott, we apologize. We were not anticipating the discussion that we were having on 2673 this morning. So, will the administrator read 3176, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3176 directs, excuse me, the Economic and Community Development Department to develop guidelines for use by cities and counties when conducting analysis of need for and supply of industrial and commercial land. It authorizes the department to make technical assistance grants to cities and counties to conduct the analysis. It directs the department to establish site certification processes for land available for industrial or commercial development. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3176 directs Land Conservation Department of Land Conservation and Development to identify amendments to comprehensive plans and land use regulations that affect availability of land zoned for industrial or commercial use, and to take actions necessary to preserve availability of strategic sites. Mr. Chair. Ray, do we have... Mr. Chair, we do. I don't know what happened to it.
I don't, does any committee member have an SMS?
No, we can't find it.
I will go to my office and find it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. And good morning, Representative Scott. And again, our apologies for the delay this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your allowing me to do this. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wayne Scott. I am a state representative from District 39. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3176. 3176 addresses the shortage of market-ready, buildable land suitable for industrial and commercial development here in Oregon. The bill is an important first step in encouraging responsible growth, new development in our state. New industrial and commercial development will, in turn, create new jobs for Oregonians. House Bill 3176 directs the Economic and Community Development Department to develop guidelines for cities and counties to use when determining the need for and supply of industrial and commercial land. It also states that the Economic and Community Development Department may provide grants to assist cities and counties in identifying the need for industrial and commercial land and to develop a local economic development plan. I emphasize that it may do that because it does not mandate that grants be awarded, thus minimizing the fiscal impact of this bill. 3176 requires the Department of Land Conservation and Development to review all proposed changes to land use regulations. This is meant to standardize regulations throughout Oregon and not give certain counties an advantage over other counties. Finally, House Bill 3176 directs the Economic and Community Development Department to establish a system for certifying specific sites as available for immediate or near-term industrial and commercial development. This is commonly known as shovel-ready land. The provisions will encourage businesses to build in Oregon, businesses that would have otherwise been discouraged by the layers of redundant bureaucracy at the city, county, and state levels. By passing 3176, you have an opportunity to send a strong message to all businesses who are considering new construction projects here in Oregon. I urge your support of House Bill 3176, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Scott? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, and Representative Scott, good morning. Thanks for bringing this before us. My only question is, there seem to be a lot of bills dealing with industrial land supply that are in various committees and various stages of getting through the process, and I thought that there was a work group that had been set up to deal with the subject of industrial lands and to try to make recommendations. Do you know, Representative Scott, were you participating in that at all, or do you know if this bill is part of that process?
Chair Girard, Representative Rosenbaum, no, I'm not aware of that, and I'm not a participant.
Chair. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, sir.
One question, Representative.
I'll try to make it be a long question then. I'm trying to understand the reason why we have to have the Economic and Community Development Department as a bureaucracy set standards for cities and counties in determining methodologies for conducting analysis concerning the supply of industrial and commercial land. Why isn't that merely the function of the city and the county through private enterprise market principles to determine the availability of such land? Why do we impose another bureaucratic method upon something that the market should handle for itself, or the local decision makers would be best able to determine?
Chair Girard, Representative Ackerman, I think that there is reasons as to why that occurs. But if you look at the land supply that is mandated to be kept available and the conditions that some of those are, and then if you further that out by whether it is desirable to be developed and to what extent it may be developed, I think it becomes a clearer path for it to be observed and to be evaluated as to how infrastructure and so on may serve it and to what it may make it available.
I have one follow-up.
Follow-up?
And I guess my point is strengthened because this mandate would require this agency to assist in this analysis for every city and every county in the state. Wouldn't that deter the final result, which is, again, trying to determine the availability for such lands for private development? And what is the fiscal impact of that to this agency?
Chair Girard, Representative Ackerman. I think it does just the reverse. I think that it helps expedite it and moves it along in a more efficient manner that allows it to be determined. As far as the fiscal impact to the agency, I suppose that would be subject to different thoughts, and so I don't know that that's available to making a determination.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Greenlee.
A brief one. This doesn't mention actions of Metro. Is this meant to exclude this analysis methodology for the industrial lands and commercial lands inventory for Metro?
Chair Girard, Representative Greenlee, I think it just is an addition to, and that's still going to be there, and this would just be an addition to that.
So Metro could use a different methodology in determining this than, say, Multnomah and Clackamas in Washington County? And
I think that's a possibility, although you would hope not.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions of Representative? Seeing none, thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much. Thanks for moving up. I appreciate it.
We shall close the public hearing on HB 3176. Okay, I'll correct my statement. We're going to recess the House Bill on 3176. Okay. Representative Richardson has a time requirement, so I'm going to again move around here to try to accommodate schedules and go and open a work session on HM1 to allow Representative Richardson to amend that bill, and perhaps we can discuss that amendment, Representative.
Yes, sir. Can I go from here? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the memorial in favor of the completion of Elk Creek Dam, as it is originally written, included a little wording that needed to be deleted and a clarification. If I direct your attention to page 2, line 8, as it is written, it says, whereas legal challenges brought by the Klamath tribe may result in the loss of more than 20,000 acre feet of surface water, there's some question as to whether or not the legal challenge is specifically being brought by the Klamath tribe. Those five words are not necessary to the effect of this memorial. And so, and the 20,000 acre feet that is the subject of a challenge turns out it's 30,000 acre feet. And so the proposed amendment would read, whereas legal challenges may result in the loss of more than 30,000 acre-feet of surface water, since it's also there's a question of whether it's groundwater or surface water, and so we're going to have it changed to surface water. So anyway, it doesn't have a substantial change on the intent of the bill in any way. It merely deletes reference to Klamath tribes, changes 20,000 to 30,000, and then changes the word groundwater to surface water.
Any questions of Representative Richardson? Seeing none, the chair would welcome a motion to accept the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move we accept the Dash One amendments to resolution HM1.
Representative Zahner moves that we approve the Dash One amendments to HM1. Is there any discussion? Is there anyone not in favor? Then we shall adopt the Dash One amendments to HM1, and the chair would seek a motion to move the bill to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I would move HM1 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner moves HM1 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, I can't support House Memorial Number 1 because the only record which was developed here was with respect to the proponents of the memorials. I didn't see any folks come in that testified against it. I don't know what the federal position is on this. I gleaned from the testimony that they're still under an injunction down there not to complete the dam. I just need more information from the other side in order to form an objective, a reasonable opinion as to whether I can support this memorial. And lacking that in this record, I will vote against the memorial.
Is there a question that you care to directly address to Representative Richardson that might help you in this area?
Well, I think that perhaps all the whereases here might be his, so I respect that position. I would like to hear someone that has a contra position to the memorial in terms of our adversarial type of process for developing a record on these issues.
Okay.
I mean, I'm glad to hear, Representative Richardson. I don't mean to say no to that, but I'd like to have someone that comes in and has a stake on the other side of the yard on it.
Would you like to respond, Representative Richardson?
Actually, I understand your position. We could go to Washington. We could go to the Corps of Engineers and try and arrange for someone to come out. It was a public hearing. Times have changed since this thing was stopped. The original concerns were environmentally based, primarily for the fish. And now with federal funding for a permanent trap and haul facility at the dam, whether it's half-built as it's presently left or completed, the concerns about the endangered species have been resolved, and so those concerns that caused the stop in construction are no longer a factor, and so it's time for us to proceed. We'd love to have this be a unanimous vote. We'd love to have your support on it. Certainly you have to do what you feel is right.
Well, my objective just is to the process. This might be a fine memorial on the facts, but I just don't have objective evidence on the other side that lends a decision. And I have found that fairly characteristic in the passage of House memorials, is that they're all basically one side to present one particular political point of view, which is fine. But I think our committee process should be set up more in an adversarial process so that we can get other people in here that have an interest in these measures.
Any further discussion by the committee? Representative,
I'm aware we're in a work session, but I believe that a sign-up sheet was put out on this bill, and that there may be somebody who signed up to testify on it. So I don't know whether we could allow that, but it would seem, given the last comment, that it might be appropriate to do so.
Mr. Chair, it is at the chair's discretion during a work session whether he wants to call witnesses to testify or not. The sign-up sheet was put out because it was published as a public hearing, possible work session.
Do we have anyone that wishes to speak?
Mr. Chair, my assistant is bringing you this. Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Doug Myers from Water Watch would like to speak to the issue.
Mr. Myers? You want to come forward, and if you will, keep your comments as brief as possible, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I am Doug Myers. I'm here representing Water Watch and Trout Unlimited. I am not here representing the Klamath tribes. I think we've got that problem hopefully fixed with an amendment to the bill, which I have not seen. But and I am not Bob Hunter. The written testimony says I am Bob Hunter. He is in Medford and is unable to come up here, but he is the expert on this. We're here to testify against House Memorial 1 for the reasons that you can see. And I just want to touch on the second point especially about the need for additional stored water. And if you really want to know about this, of course, the Corps of Engineers would be the one to ask. But Lost Creek Reservoir is already in place, and you can see the amount of acre feet, 35,000 of water allocated to irrigation, 3,000 of which has been contracted, 10,000 acre feet of water located to allocated to municipal and industrial use, 2,000 acre feet has been contracted. So there's a big surplus there. You can read what Applegate, which is completed, that's 26,000 acre feet allocated to irrigation, of which only 3,000 has been contracted. So there is quite a bit of surplus water there. And then it goes on to talk about flood control benefits. Lost Creek Dam, which is in place again, will take 8 feet off the head of a 100-year flood at Grants Pass, while Elk Creek would take only another foot off the head of a 100-year flood. The dam isn't designed for hydropower. And then the harm to, on the second page, the harm to the Rogue River Fish and Wildlife, if you allow this dam to go forward, and indeed the water is built up, it destroys all the spawning grounds for winter and summer steelhead. And it goes on to talk about the ESA. So for those reasons, we do oppose the memorial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Not Mr. Hunter.
I am not Mr. Hunter.
Right.
And I attached just a few editorials, and there's one op-ed. There's an editorial from the Mail Tribune. There's an editorial from the Oregonian. And I have a little stack that Bob Hunter faxed me yesterday of other editorials and so forth that do oppose the dam. Thank you.
I have a couple questions I feel I have to ask.
I don't want to extend a big dialogue on this, but Representative Richardson.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr. Myers, were you here when in this room when Sue Capillus was here last week?
Partly I was, Representative Richardson.
Because it would be really advantageous if these things had been brought up while she was here and able to respond. I would. Let me ask just a couple of questions. Are you aware that the film that we saw, which was quoting one of the engineers that was involved in the dam, indicated that it was easily set up for hydroelectric power. Are you aware of that?
I was in the room when that was on, yes, sir.
Okay. And are you also aware that Sue Capillus, when she was testifying, indicated that, and the materials indicated that the flood reduction was more than twice what is indicated by Mr. Hunter in this document?
I'm unaware of that.
No further questions, except he was here.
Thank you, Representative Richard. Thank you very much. We have a motion on the floor, basically, from Representative Zahner to move HM1 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes.
Representative Doyle.
Yes.
Representative Ackerman.
No.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Girard.
Aye. Representative Richardson, would you like to carry this bill?
Would, thank you.
Representative Richardson will carry HM1, sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as amended. We finally got rid of one. Okay, we're going to go back now and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2673. We've closed the work session on HM1. We'll resume the testimony on 2673. And where we left off was with John Chandler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2673. I'll be very brief. We are neutral on the bill. We would like to appreciate the fact very much that proponents addressed some of our concerns from previous conversations. We weren't aware that the problem was as extensive as some appear to think it is, but we're happy to fix it. I used to serve on a city council in a previous life, and I would have thought I had to disclose this stuff to begin with. I think most of our local elected officials think they already had to. I did want to put on the record some concerns, and I've been talking with the proponent of the bill. Some of them have already come up dealing with the definitional conflict between ORS 244 and what would be in now 197. I think that does need to be addressed. There's also the issue of, in line 13, page 1, what a prospective contract business relationship or agency relationship is. That's undefined. Similarly, on lines 20 through 22 of page 1, where it extends beyond the local elected official or appointed official, such as a planning commissioner, to the staff and other employees of the local government, we think that's a little overbroad, and I think we'll be able to work with the proponents to address those concerns. I think that the bill is heading in a positive direction. Local proceedings should be above reproach. If we have ethical problems perceived or otherwise, those should be addressed. The language of this bill probably could use some work to make sure it doesn't conflict and put local elected officials in a quandary as to which standards they're following under which proceeding. And to my way of thinking, both as an attorney and an advocate and as a former elected official, the standard ought not change regardless of the subject matter in front of the elected official. So I want to put those concerns on the record. We'll be happy to work with the proponent as the bill goes forward to address some of these issues, and be glad to take any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Chandler?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Harlan Levy?
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. With respect to House Bill 2673, I have to agree with the testimony you heard from the previous speaker as well as the representative from the League of Oregon Cities. We do have one additional concern. If you turn to page 5 of the bill, Section 17, subsection B, the bill would require that LUBA remand a decision if they make this finding, and then subsection C creates a very limited exception to that rule. We would request, and we did make this request in the last legislative session, House Bill 3908 as well, that subsection B, the shall be changed to may, and then that would eliminate any need for the additional subsection C, so that could be entirely deleted. The problem that we see is you may have a perfectly valid decision made, for example, by unanimous decision of the local decision maker, and then if one of the decision makers was found to have violated these provisions, that would provide grounds for LUBA to remand that unless they made this finding that they conclusively determined that participation did not affect the outcome. And I don't know how they would do that, because LUBA usually, in many cases, admonishes people that come before it that it's not its job to review the transcript and record before it. So we would just ask that additional change be made. I have heard that there will be some amendments coming to this bill. And with that, I will close my testimony and be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Any questions of Mr. Levy? Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did your night sleep last night?
Not really.
Maybe.
Jim Nass? Jim, there seems to have been several legal questions in regard to this conflict of interest, whether there's a conflict of interest with other conflict of interest rules.
I was going to say thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to speak. I'm not sure I want to answer those. Do you want me to speak first or answer?
No, please speak first. Oh. Yes, identify yourself.
Jim Nass, legal counsel for the appellate courts. The judicial department takes no position on the policy choices posed by this bill. Our focus, as usual, is on the technical parts of it, and the concern I have is on page 3, lines 4 through 7. The bill provides that on appeal before an appellate court, failure to make a disclosure under subsection 1 or the failure to record the disclosure is ground for a remand. The remand for failure to record the disclosure isn't an issue because presumably the record would show that a LCDC board member disclosed something and simply didn't get into written findings. The problem is if the official failed to make a disclosure at all, how will we know that? If it isn't in the record, there's no way for us to know that. And our concern is that this suggests that the appellate court would have to take evidence on a board member's interest in a matter. And, of course, appellate court's not really set up to take evidence. So that's our concern with that little bit of the aspect of it. And I noticed that the previous witness drew attention to page 5, and it appears that before LUBA, there's some sort of authority to hold a evidentiary hearing, and I don't know whether LUBA is set up to do that, but I do know that our court does not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
Can I ask a legal question again?
Certainly, Representative Greenlee. This is the man to ask.
Okay. But I was intrigued with the fact that the bill suggests that under the quorum measure that if an official has a conflict, he may participate but not vote. And the Green Book suggests that under those circumstances, the official may vote but not discuss or debate the issue. Do you have any sense of, is this intended to change the general statement here, or is it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, unfortunately, for better or for worse, this is outside my area of expertise. And I couldn't see if we'd be able to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Nass, very much.
Thank you.
Dave Honeycutt.
You can get this oriented. That's
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. We are also neutral on this bill. One legal point and one policy point. The legal point, just to answer Mr. Nass's the question that he posed to the committee, LUBA does have the authority to conduct evidentiary hearings. They do it very infrequently, but there is express authority for them to do that. So LUBA can, and if there isn't evidence in the record on the conflict, LUBA could conceivably conduct an evidentiary hearing to make that determination. In all the LUBA appeals that I've done in the course of my career, I've never been involved in a LUBA evidentiary hearing. It's very rare. From a policy perspective, we don't oppose the bill as written. However, we do think it's a one-way street. Requiring a city councilor or a county commissioner or a planning commissioner to disclose a conflict of interest when there's a potential business relationship seems appropriate, but the converse is also true as well. If you had a city councilor or county commissioner or planning commissioner who would be negatively economically impacted by approval of a proposed application, and it seems to me appropriate if we're going down this road to require that city official or planning commissioner or county commissioner to make a disclosure under this bill as well. An easy example, you've got somebody with a restaurant, an existing restaurant in town that at night is silly enough to volunteer to be on the planning commission. I come in with an applicant who wants to build a restaurant right next door. Obviously, if we're going to disclose business relationships, it seems to me appropriate for that planning commissioner, who would obviously be negatively impacted by the construction of a restaurant right that would compete with his right next door, to make a disclosure as well, and this bill doesn't provide for that. And I think that just sort of highlights what the what Linda Ludwig from the League was saying, that if we're going to go down this road with conflict of interest, we'd be much better doing a more comprehensive overhaul rather than applying simply to land use officials under 2673. So we don't have a problem with this bill, but we would like to see if it's going to move forward that a more comprehensive that we take a more comprehensive look if there is a problem, that it's solved that way.
Very good. Any questions of Mr. Honegger? Seeing none, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
I think it is probably to our advantage to have a work group made up of those who testified today in regards to this bill to refine or maybe narrow the bill's focus. And Randy, I'm going to ask you if you'd kind of chair that group, if you would do that, and come back in a couple weeks to this committee and see if we can have this bill amended that it will address some of the grievances that were brought forth this morning. Thank you. Right. Okay, we will close. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2673. Recess the House public hearing, and we will open House Bill 2674. I think that's the next one on the list. I don't know where my committee guy disappeared to. Do we have a sign-up list?
You have a good assistant here. He'll take care of it.
We do. Well, Randy, you're back here on the next one, too. So, 2674. Okay. Committee, we have three speakers signed up on this bill.
Mr. Chair, if you'll allow me a second to get through for the testimony that's drafted. I do not have copies to distribute because I don't. Because it's not in a distributable form. For the record, Mr. Chair, Randy Tucker, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I believe you have heard testimony already from us this session about our efforts to protect farmland from non-farm uses, and I believe you've also heard us describe our Farmer Advisory Committee that has helped us to develop our policies on farmland protection. Members of our Farmer Advisory Committee are concerned that additional development in farm zones threatens the land base on which their industry depends. We oppose House Bill 2674 at this time because it would increase the location of non-farm uses in inclusive farm use zones. We don't object to commercial ranchers supplementing their farm income from a secondary source, such as hosting paid guests at their ranch. We do, however, object to converting EFU-zoned rangeland into little motels for which livestock is only a secondary and incidental use. Authorizing more non-farm development in our EFU zones is inconsistent with our 24-year-old state agricultural land use policy to maintain the maximum amount of the state's limited supply of agricultural land for production of agriculture. And as you've heard us testify in the past, we believe the EFU zones are already support too many non-farm uses. In discussion last night with Carrie McLaren, I'm here on her behalf, our farmland and farm range and forest land protection advocate. We discussed the definition of a guest ranch, which is something that is incidental and accessory to an existing livestock operation. It's important that that these guest ranches not become the primary use and that a livestock operation is incidental to it. And so the threshold question we need to ask about these things is, are these value-added opportunities for real farmers, or are they merely a justification for building a small resort? The current criteria do not ensure that guest facilities do not replace the ranch as the primary use of the property. And so we've had concerns about these guest ranches. This is all by way of background, the guest ranch issue. We've had concerns about these since they were first put into the law a few sessions ago, and there have been little bills each session. I believe there's a sunset on these guest ranches. Last session there was a bill that extended the sunset. This bill before you today, from what I can tell, would greatly expand the areas of the state in which these operations could be located.
Randy, I'm going to ask Ron Ebert to come up and share the dais with you, in that I know Ron has a lot of background in this area as far as this bill and what it addresses and might be of assistance.
That's great. He knows a lot more about it than I do.
That's what I was trying to say.
you never hurt my feelings by suggesting that I don't know enough. Because I don't. So I'll just cut to my main point and let Ron fill in the background, definitely. The main point is that in changing the population number in this bill, you essentially say that guest ranches can be located anywhere east of the Cascades except within 10 miles of Bend. To my understanding, there's not another city of 50,000 people east of the Cascades. So all of the rangeland beyond 10 miles from Bend becomes free territory for guest ranches. And there have already been cases where there's a case in Baker County where an owner of a guest ranch sold all the buffalo that were on that were the livestock that justified the existence of the ranch. There have been other cases where I believe it's been determined that the livestock were not located on the same parcel as the guest ranch. There hasn't yet been a study, to my knowledge, and Ron can correct me if I'm wrong, about the existing guest ranch provisions, the impact that they've had on our rangeland. We need to know more about these operations, whether we're creating little motels that are not really associated with ranches, or whether these are operations that are in fact a value-added secondary component related to an ongoing ranch operation. So in the absence of that information, the extent of the broadening of the opportunity that this bill would affect gives us pause, and we would urge you to not adopt it at this time.
Any questions?
If that makes sense.
Hey, Randy, thank you.
Morning.
I'm sorry, Representative Greenlick had a question.
Randy, would you help me a little bit? This says, what's restricted now? Yeah, I read it the same way you did, that the only thing that was restricted with this is...
I believe there's a
event, so.
Ron will be better to answer the question, but I did do some homework on this last night. My understanding is that you need to have 160 acres. Is that correct, Ron? Mm-hmm. In order to establish.
But that's not changed here. The only thing that's been changed here is the 50,000. Is the 5,000?
Right.
The 50,000. So I was wondering, there must be a set of cities with urban growth boundaries.
Correct.
Between 5,000 and 45,000, it has this 10-mile radius around them, and those are the only things that are going to be eliminated. And I was just wondering how many of those.
Oh, I don't know the answer to that question, but I do believe that one of the rationales for that is to not establish operations that are competing with the kinds of guest facilities that are in those cities. I could be wrong about that as well, but that certainly is something that we look at and say, well, you know, we should be. To the greatest extent possible, not undermining those businesses. I don't know the answer as far as how many cities are 5,000 or more. I don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, Ron Eber with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Currently, or at least based on the population statistics that were used for this bill, at the end of 1996, there were approximately 12 cities in eastern Oregon that had a population greater than 5,000. Those are the larger cities out there: Baker City, Prineville, Bend, Redmond, Madras, Cape Falls, Ontario, Hermiston, Milton Freewater, Pendleton, LeGrand, and the Dalles. And I think Mr. Tucker is correct, is that with this change in the bill, it would now allow these facilities within 10 miles to all those cities, likely except the city of Bend.
and I can give you more background on the original bill when you're ready.
Am I confused here? Does our SMS refer to 10 miles from a UGB whose population is greater than 5,000, but the bill says 50,000?
No, it's changing the 5 to 50.
Right, current law is 5,000. Mr. Chair, current law is 5,000, and what the bill does is changes it to 50,000.
So it
which essentially
wipes out those 10-mile circles around, those 5-mile circles around.
Exactly.
Around those 10 cities.
Committee, have any questions for Mr. Eber?
He doesn't testify.
If I might, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Ron Eber for the department. This bill was developed between ourselves and several proponents of guest ranches in 1997 and the agricultural community. The intent was to allow these kinds of guest facilities with bona fide livestock operations. And a number of standards were put in the bill to ensure that it was on a bona fide livestock operation, that the size of the facility was scaled proportionate to the size of the ranch. The 10-mile limit was put in the statute, and this I should mention was a pilot program because it did have a sunset in 2001, and in last session it was extended out to 2005. One of the initial proposals that was behind the bill was a small operation that was raising some bison. It had been a bed and breakfast that had sort of evolved into a guest ranch, and so there was a concern that if the bill didn't have this limit, we could end up with some quasi-hotel, restaurant-type operations, bringing commercial development into the farm zone that wasn't really tied to a commercial livestock operation. Since the bill was passed, there were about three or four of these approved in the 97-99 time frame, and by my count, there's been about another four that have been approved since. Unfortunately, I don't have details about those, the scale of those operations. I can tell you that I know one of them is on a 160-acre parcel, a couple of them are on parcels approximately 550 acres, and the rest of them range from 2,000 to 10,000 acres. So the concern that these might be going on smaller parcels and be of a more commercial nature, not tied to agriculture, doesn't seem at this point to have come true. We are, in conjunction with the Department of Economic Development, their tourism division, having to bring a report to you next session before the bill sunsets on whether to more closely evaluate this. If the committee wants, can check with the counties and get more information on these operations. We're not here. We're neutral on the bill. It does have the sunset clause. It is a pilot program. We have some experience under the existing provisions. Whether or not there's going to be a run on operations within the 10 miles of some of these other cities and bring commercial development outside the urban growth boundaries is unclear and might be worth the 2 years to see what happens. We're not concerned that it's going to cause major problems. But I wanted to make sure the committee knew that 10-mile limit was put in there to try and be, along with the other safeguards in the bill, to ensure that we didn't get commercial activities close to some of the major cities that really were not tied with bona fide livestock operations. So if you have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Any questions for Mr. Eber?
Yes, sir.
Representative Greenland.
Is it typical that around these cities, I'm familiar with some of them but not others, that there'll be livestock operations appropriate for this kind of a facility inside of 10 miles? No. I mean, around Prineville, I can't imagine, but...
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenleaf. I couldn't really say. A lot of these cities have a lot of irrigated land around them. Some of them may have livestock operations. I know one of the facilities already put in was within 10 miles of Bend that went in 1999. There's a large one that went in Lake County, Baker County, Gillum County, and Harney County. So there are large operations out there that, at, certainly at 160 acres, that could avail themselves of this this proposal, because you do need at least 160 acres before you can do anything.
A brief follow-up. Well, how did one get within 10 miles of Bend? That would be excluded under this.
Oh, excuse me. Chair Garrard, Representative Green Lake. It's not within 10 miles of Bend. It's just outside 10 miles of Bend. Part of the parcel that it's on came within the 10-mile limit, and that led to the amendment in 1999 that Mr. Honeycutt and I worked on to ensure as long as the facility was outside 10 miles, it didn't matter if the parcel extended inside.
Mr. Chair, I believe, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong here as well, that there was a change that from no part, I believe, of the parcel could be within 10 miles to the majority of the parcel could not be within 10 miles. Is that correct? Anyway, there was a technical change, a relatively minor change, a session or two ago on this, and this is the kind of thing that's been happening over the last couple of sessions.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that change was in 1999 in Senate Water and Land Use Committee.
Randy, does Thousand Friends have a position on this bill?
We oppose the bill. We are, you know, I'm not going to say that this is our number one priority of the session, but mainly on principle, Mr. Chair, we oppose the addition of more non-farm uses in the farm zones. We don't know really what the impact of this bill would be, and we have some concerns about understanding the impact of the existing guest ranches as well, based on some of the anecdotal information that I mentioned as far as guest ranches suddenly not having any livestock anymore. A definition of a ranch is tied to the production of livestock, which, as I learned last night again, is defined to include just, I believe, sheep, cattle, bison, and
horses.
Thank you, Ron. And if there's no ranch associated with the guest ranch, we obviously have some concerns. Just would like to know more about how these things are being situated, the impacts they may be having on the farm zone.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question for Ron. The language in the law right now says an existing and continuing livestock operation. So what would happen in the scenario that Randy just described if there ceased to be a livestock operation and one of these, I guess they're dude ranches, it sounds like what we're talking about, was still in place? Is there the ability to go back then retroactively and withdraw the permission to continue operating the motel part of it?
Chair Garrard, Representative Rosenbaum, legally or theoretically that could happen. Whether or not the county would enforce in that situation, I couldn't tell you. The sense was that the sizes in the bill in terms of acreage and the requirements would lead to someone having a bona fide operation and likely would not get rid of the livestock operation. If they did that as a farm operation, they would lose their farm assessment, and if you're on a large piece of ground, that could be or even a smaller piece of ground could be quite a substantial property tax hit. We have not seen that happen. I know there's been some issues with that one operation out in Baker County, where they were, I think, taking some of the bison off-site for some grazing. Whether they've sold them or not, I couldn't tell you. If the committee would like, I can check with the counties and get some more information about the existing operations in terms of their size, number of rooms, the nature of their operations. I have not been able to do so prior to this hearing for that. I apologize.
Would the committee desire that?
It's not a word.
Apparently it's not necessary. Any further questions of either of our guests?
This whole thing is sunsetted, is that right, sir?
That's my
understanding. Anyway, so yeah. If we change it, we'll just be continuous.
Thank you. Don Schellenberg is the only other person we have to sign up. He's not here, so he therefore forfeits his ability to speak.
Mr. Chair, if I may, he asked me to chase him down. He's watching another hearing. If you're going to have the opportunity, if I could go and try to find him, but I suddenly was called forward and didn't have a chance to do that.
How much time, Randy?
If you give me 3 or 4 minutes to find him, if you'll give him the leave to come and testify, if he decides to do that, I'd be glad to go.
Okay, we'll ask the committee to stand at ease for 3 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're finished with the hearing for the day?
With this bill.
Right. Oh, I mean, I think it would be fine to... I don't want to start running the committee here. I'm sorry. I don't want to say what's fine and what's not fine.
We'll give you three minutes.
I was going to suggest a recess, the hearing or whatever. But
you stand
far be it from me to do that.
Are we standing at ease? And
the committee will stand at ease till approximately 10:10.
I will go find Don really quickly.